Little Pooh, I live in your radio. This is my dog, Sugar Bear. He lives in here, too.
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the comedy continues. In fact, it's getting better and better and better. Which, of course, means sillier and stupider and more ridiculous as time goes by. And, of course, I don't mean to disparage or cast any kind of sarcasm or anything else onto the person who died and those who were injured in the train wreck. Our condolences go out to them, and we certainly hope that they regain all of their health as quickly as possible. Now, yesterday they first released that the president of the railroad stated that he had received warnings signed by the sons of the Gestapo that said that they were going to do something to the trains. They also said that the president of the railroad had received calls and notes from the sons of the Gestapo claiming credit for this deed. They also quoted Sheriff Arpao of Maricopa County, Arizona, as stating that they found several notes signed by the sons of the Gestapo near the railroad tracks, and they also reported that somebody on the train handed a bartender a note on the train claiming that the train was going to be derailed and blaming, you know, it all on the FBI and the BATF, and those are the real sons of the Gestapo, ladies and gentlemen. Which is probably where all this came from to begin with. And then, to find out what the truth was, I called the sheriff's department. And they told me there were no notes. There's no sons of the Gestapo. Nobody claimed credit for it. We called the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who told us the same thing yesterday. Now, the press is reporting that Sheriff Arpao definitely said that there are several notes which are being shown to the governor of Arizona, and copies are being sent to President Clinton from the sons of the Gestapo. Now the sheriff's department will not confirm or deny. They will not talk. The FBI will not confirm or deny. They will not talk. And the press reports are flowing, filled with their venom and lies. Connecting this with the Oklahoma City bombing, with the militia, with right-wing hate groups. This is incredible. Same thing all over again. And who is the target? Folks, the target is the poor, ignorant American sheeple out there in the hinterland who knows nothing from anything and can't even find his own rear end unless somebody points it out to him, who believes all this crap. It's the demonizing of anyone who holds close to his heart the principles and ideals upon which this country was founded. They don't care who you are. They don't care how good you are. They don't care what your intent is. They want to destroy you. They want one world. Just like I read to you the other night in the documents, straight out of the horse's mouth, the 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. And there's still some of you out there who won't believe it. You'll never believe it until it happens and you're just smacked right in the face with it like a dead fish across the chops. And then it'll be too late. Nobody destroyed this country from outside, ladies and gentlemen. It's been done from inside by traitors right here. They have no conception of liberty. They spout that talk. But that's all it is. Mouthing. They don't love liberty. They don't even know what it is. They want a one-world totalitarian socialist government. And if Americans keep going in the vein that they are flowing, they're going to get it. And all I have to do to realize that that's true is listen to the program that comes on right before me and the one that comes on right after me. I don't have to listen to all of it. I just turn them on a little bit to check whether or not we're being jammed, what kind of propagation exists out there, and to try to see, you know, what's on people's minds. And it's amazing. Never ceases to amaze me. If the people are supposed to be on to what's happening, if the people who call themselves patriots, if the people who are supposed to have been studying all of this stuff and have identified our enemies and know where we're going are this abjectly stupid, there is no chance. None at all. Listen to some of this. I'm just going to read you some of this. Sabotage tracks and a note from Sons of Gestapo brought a swarm of federal agents to an isolated patch of desert where a train derailed off a 30-foot-high bridge, killing one person and injuring at least 78. I understand some guy that was connected to the Iran-Contra arms for drugs deal was on the radio in Texas and said that the Sons of the Gestapo are a Mexican gang that steal from trains. Total bullshit. I heard Tom Valentine say just a few moments ago on his broadcast that the Sons of the Gestapo are some Washington state group. Total bullshit. There are no Sons of the Gestapo, ladies and gentlemen, anywhere. You want to see Sons of the Gestapo? Go down to your local FBI or BATF office. Take a good look. That's the only Gestapo that I've been able to identify right now in this country. Someone obviously intended to drop the train off the trestle into the ravine, Downs told a Washington news conference. Downs is the president of Amtrak. The sabotage would have taken about 10 minutes for someone with a basic knowledge of railways, he said. A note or notes found outside the train referred to the federal sieges at Waco, Texas, and Ruby Ridge, Idaho, rallying points for anti-government extremists. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe R. Powell said he refused to detail the contents of the note, but said it was signed Sons of Gestapo. Well, according to what he told us, there were no notes. Now he won't say one way or the other. He won't even talk about it. And guess what, folks? Guess what we discovered today? Maricopa County Sheriff Joe R. Powell used to be a member of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. That's right. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe R. Powell used to be a member of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The FBI refuses to comment on the note, and R. Powell, a former agent of the BATF, stopped talking to reporters after a private briefing with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and other federal officials. How about that? An electronic database search of U.S. newspapers found no mention of Sons of Gestapo, nor did a search of about 6 months' worth of Internet discussion groups and worldwide web pages. Are you listening to me, ladies and gentlemen? Nor did a search of about 6 months' worth of Internet discussion groups and worldwide web pages. And they're turning control, ladies and gentlemen, of a great portion of the Internet directly to companies which are proprietary fronts for the Central Intelligence Agency. And we'll talk about that another night. We've got it all right here. Klan Watch. Ooh, Morris Dees says he never heard of the Sons of Gestapo. Boy, I would have thought he would have been up there trumpeting about how they were tied to the militia and all that stuff. He said it could be some kind of local group. Or this could be Fred the Farmer, who's mad at Amtrak for cutting across his land, and that's probably closer to the truth than anything. Let me see what else we got here. Veteran federal investigators spoke on condition of anonymity, told the Associated Press in Washington that agents would not jump to conclusions about possible suspects. Well, that's nice of those fellers. Wish they'd tell the media that, too. The investigator noted that a disgruntled or dismissed Amtrak employee or someone else bent on mischief might concoct a note to deflect attention. I'm going to tell you right now, whoever did it knew an awful lot about trains. They knew about train schedules. They knew which track to do it on because there wouldn't be a train by in a long time. They knew how to wire the track so it wouldn't switch the signals to red and stop the train. This wasn't some Joe Blow dorky dude. Nope. This is somebody that knew exactly what they were doing. Now, here's another one. Amtrak President Thomas Downs said Monday the derailment of a passenger train in the Arizona desert was caused by a person who knew something about railroading and did not rule out a disgruntled employee. Well, thank heaven for an honest man. Thank heaven for an honest man. You ought to write Amtrak President Thomas Downs and thank him. Now, there's some place in here where he says that he didn't get... Oh, here it is. Amtrak President Thomas Downs said Amtrak had received no threatening letters. Period. So, right from the horse's mouth, the president of Amtrak just said the media is a pack of liars. So whoever put that out... simply lie. Now listen to this from Washington, Reuters. Reuters is making up stuff here. Making up stuff, ladies and gentlemen, lying again. A little known neo-Nazi group called Sons of the Gestapo signed two notes left at the scene. The notes referred to incidents at Waco, Texas, and Ruby Ridge, Idaho, where federal law enforcement officials were involved in deadly shootouts with anti-government groups. Well, tell me, Reuters, what little-known Nazi, neo-Nazi group is called the Sons of the Gestapo? I want to know that. Tomorrow, I want everybody listening to call Reuters and ask them, where did they get that? What little-known neo-Nazi group? Why did they blatantly lie? And who is responsible for making that up and putting that out over the wire as a news release? Which, of course, is picked up by the little dummy parrot puppet cutesy dimple cheek anchor peoples in red over the air. A rogue's gallery of suspects. Federal officials are flocking to Arizona's southern desert to investigate the sabotage and derailment of an Amtrak train on Monday. Although suspicion immediately fell on right-wing militias, Times' Elaine Shannon notes a number of people could be responsible. There are a lot of bad actors in Arizona, from the traditional Cosa Nostra families, to motorcycle gangs, to gun nuts, to Mexican cocaine traffickers, to freelance rednecks of all description. And I'm going to tell you, you little lying twit, Elaine Shannon, this is the truth. There are more scumbag, law-breaking, crooks, murderers, rapists, terrorists, and otherwise all-around assholes in your state of New York than there ever has been, is, or ever will be in the state of Arizona. And that's the truth. I'm really sick of this, folks. Arizona has one of the lowest populations of all the states in the country. And we really have very little crime here. And one of the reasons we have very little crime here is everybody owns a gun. And you have to be very polite to people. If you're not, you're liable to get your head blown off. Societies where people own guns are polite societies. And yes, there are some stupid fools who every once in a while do something stupid with a gun, just like everywhere else. But I'll stack Arizona up against New York, where little Miss Cheeksy Dimple Cheeksy Lane lives, any day of the week. Oh, we've enhanced security on our own part of the railroad in the Northeast Corridor. Downs, speaking outside Washington Union Station, cited heightened police vigilance at what he called key areas. He said security had been stepped up around the country where most of the track is owned by freight railroads. What a bunch of baloney. This is the biggest crock of crap I have ever heard in my life. Do you know, ladies and gentlemen, exactly how many miles of railroad track there are in desolate areas where nobody ever goes? Security, my rear end. There is no security. There never can be. Anybody that wants to derail a train can do it anytime they want to. I hope that they never do it. But the truth is, there aren't enough security people in this entire nation to even attempt to provide any kind of security against this type of thing. Even if you put one person on every mile of track, he couldn't even see what was happening a half mile away, in most cases. Federal Bureau of Investigation Special Agent Larry McCormick told a news conference close to the site of the disaster, quote, "We are very confident and very sure that we will solve this crime," end quote. Yeah, they probably will. They'll find some poor, stupid idiot and plant some dynamite and some crowbars in his car. And he'll go up for the rest of his life. Seems to be the way it's done around here, all around the country. Now, I don't know if you've seen a photograph of the train wreck itself, ladies and gentlemen, but I have one here right in front of me. And I got to tell you, this is very strange. They say that the tracks were pulled up over a 19-foot section to make the train fall into a gully. Yet I'm looking at this photograph, ladies and gentlemen, the engine went right across the place where the rail was supposedly pried up, made it all the way across the trestle and across the gully, and is still on the tracks. About three cars back from the engine is where the train began to go off the tracks, and there's one, two, three, four and a half cars off the rails. So the engine was not derailed. The train was derailed after the engine passed over this location. What that means, I don't really know. I'm not a rail expert, but it just doesn't look right. Okay, tonight, as I promised, we will continue with the deposition of William R. Stringer, FBI agent extraordinaire, who told the truth when he discovered that he probably wouldn't live another year. And he didn't. Music from last night and tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is by my good friend Mark Nine from his CD entitled This Island Earth. And you should get a copy if you can. He doesn't even know I'm saying this, and I don't make any money from it. I just like his music. I like the way he has meshed what's going on in the world with the music to wake people up. It's great. I continue where I left off last night. Answer, Chet Dillard, in order that I might inform Judge Dillard of the above information. The reason I had Mr. Burris Dunn to bring me to Judge Dillard's office is that he is a friend of mine, and I had previously informed Mr. Dunn of this information, and he had previously asked me if it would be all right if he informed Judge Dillard of the information that I had concerning Byron De La Beckwith, and whether or not I would be willing to go and talk with the judge. I informed Mr. Dunn that I would be glad to talk to the judge. In fact, I was anxious to talk to the judge, as I wanted to have this information made of record to an official who was in a position to do something about it. Mr. Dunn and I are friends and have been friends for a number of years. Question, when did I meet you? In 1973? Mr. Dunn, something like that. Answer, we became friends in 1973 when both our sons were working at the same grocery store in Jackson, Mississippi. It is necessary for me to have someone to take me places, as I was shot on August 18, 1971, while I was on duty with the FBI in Jackson, Mississippi. I was at the rear of 1148 Lewis Street, Jackson, Mississippi, where the FBI and the Jackson Police Department had gone to make several arrests of members of the Republic of New Africa. This address being their Jackson headquarters. My gunshot wound was caused by being shot at close range with an AR-180, which is a civilian version of the military M16 assault rifle. This rifle has a muzzle velocity of 4,000 feet per second, and when it hit my left upper leg, it entered my leg and tumbled like the M16 shell is supposed to do, or bullet is supposed to do, and tore my leg inside to shreds. I had surgery about a week after I was shot at the Mississippi Baptist Hospital in Jackson by Dr. Henry Tyler. The reason for the delay in surgery on my leg was that no doctor in Jackson had ever done surgery on anyone who had been shot with an M16 or like rifle, and they did not understand the damage that it does and the fact that the bullet tumbles upon entering flesh. And due to the fact that it is traveling about 4,000 feet per second, it literally disintegrates, and I still have parts of the bullet in my leg. Many pieces of the bullet were left in my leg because Dr. Tyler stated that to cut into the remaining muscle in my leg in order to get to the particles of bullet would weaken my leg so that I would not even be able to stand on it, much less walk. My gunshot wound never got well on the outside, or on the inside rather, as it did on the outside, and it is now infected to the point where I have been informed by doctors, due to the infection in my gunshot wound, that if this infection gets in my bloodstream, it could cause me to have blood poisoning, and I would die almost immediately. I have been told by doctors not to expect to live beyond a year or so if the infection in my leg does not get better. I desire that this information be made public and get to the proper authorities who can do something about the injustice to framing Mr. Beckwith by the FBI, as I would like to see this done before I die, which could be today or any other day in the near future. Anything else you want in there? Question. You mentioned something in there about Mr. Webb putting the dynamite in Mr. Beckwith's car. How did he get the keys? Answer. Oh. Question. How did he have keys to Beckwith's car? Answer. I can't tell you how he had them, but I can tell you how others have been gotten. For instance, the head of the Klan in West Point, Mississippi, the way they got the keys to his pickup truck, they went to the dealer where he bought it, and they get the original invoice. And on the original invoice, it has the key numbers. And then they have the dealer to make them a set of keys to fit that vehicle. Mr. Dunn. Bill. Judge Dillard. Let me ask him one more along the line then. Question. You mentioned Mr. Ingram. Was he Mr. Moore's number one assistant, and would he have had knowledge of this? Answer. Of what? Question. Of planting the dynamite on Beckwith. Answer. No, that happened after Jim got transferred to Washington. Question. Okay. Answer. In fact, he may have already left for Washington and been in Chicago by that time. I don't know. But it was after he had left here, because Jim got transferred out of here about 6 months after I got here. Question. Okay. So then, when you came here, though, he was the number one assistant to... Answer. Well, actually, the assistant agent in charge was the number one, and Jim was probably the number two assistant to Roy Moore. They didn't have any supervisors. They were stupidvisors. Those guys over there that Roy had as supervisors didn't have sense enough to get in out of the rain. I knew them. Ernie Cochran, he was supply clerk in the mobile office years ago before I became old enough to become an agent, and he too, and I was the assistant chief clerk of the office. And he was so stupid that the supply catalog might as well have been written in Greek because he couldn't read it. And then another supervisor they had up there was, I can't think of his name now, Mr. Dunn. Elton Lindbergh? Answer, no, Lindbergh was stupid. Larry Beteau. Larry took Jim's place when he left. Beteau, dumb as a pile of wood. Question. Bill, one other thing. In all of this activity, the Terrence case and Terror in the Night and all these books about all of this, Matthews comes out as supposedly being the Imperial Wizard of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And there's a lot of people that believe that he was a plant from the beginning and that he actually made the bombing device that was used in the Terrence case in Meridian, that Terrence carried to Meridian. Answer, he might have been. I don't know. Let me tell you about that case. I don't know how the FBI found out that Tommy Terrence was going to Meridian, but they found out about it. So I think they found out through Kathy Ainsworth, who was an FBI informant, who was also an informant for Fred Sanders of the police department. And, in fact, Fred Sanders is the one that introduced the FBI to her so they could use her. And she, I don't know who she informed, but she informed somebody in the FBI office that Tommy was going to Meridian. And they told her not to go, but they didn't tell her why not to go. And so Tommy talked her into going with him. And in the meantime, Roy Moore had Frank Watts, Special Agent Frank Watts, and Special Agent John Proctor, and other agents of the FBI, assigned to the Meridian office to get the local authorities to set up a roadblock for Tommy Terrence and to assassinate him when he got there. I understand from talking with former Special Agents Frank Proctor, or John Proctor, and Frank Watts, that the Lawrence County Sheriff's Office did set up a roadblock at a certain place. Mr. Dunn, Lauderdale County, don't you mean? Answer, yeah, Lauderdale County. I said Lawrence, didn't I? It was Lauderdale County. And when they were tipped that Tommy Terrence was approaching the roadblock, just as he turned into the driveway of the place where he was going, they fired upon Tommy Terrence in his automobile, there being numerous officers who fired upon Terrence's automobile and allegedly making it look like Bonnie and Clyde's car when the Texas Rangers shot it up. As a result of this attack upon Terrence and his automobile, Kathy Ainsworth, who was riding in the automobile with Terrence, was allegedly killed by one of the bullets from a weapon being fired by the law enforcement officers. I learned most of this information, other than talking to John Proctor and Frank Watts. I learned some of the information about her being an informant from Fred Sanders, former policeman with the Jackson Police Department, who told me that Kathy Ainsworth was his informant and that he had introduced her to the FBI so the FBI could use her. He said he never thought that she would be killed as a result of being an FBI informant, but she was. She was killed as a result of Roy Moore ordering his Meridian men to have local authorities set up a roadblock and assassinate Tommy Terrence when he arrived. So Roy K. Moore is just as guilty of murder, in my opinion, as the guy who pulled the trigger on the weapon that killed Kathy Ainsworth. Question. You know, I know Fred Sanders, and we're buddies over at the American Legion Post number 1. As a coincidence, he had indicated he wanted to come and talk to me about this thing, and I think, you know, I'll pursue it. Answer. Yeah, Fred can tell you a lot. Fred knows a lot about what's going on around here. In fact, Fred was the first local policeman that I worked with. He and old Outhead Pace. I worked with them, and that's when they found out all FBI agents weren't sons of bitches, which implies that most of them are. Mr. Dunn, may I add something here? Do you need to pause it? The court. Well, you want to get it on the deposition, though? Mr. Dunn, it doesn't matter. The court, meaning court reporter. Let it only be his statement on the deposition in case they want to use it somewhere and might want to enter it. I'm going to see if this thing can be used in courts and everything, so I want it to be all of Bill's statement. Question. When you were describing your medical situation and everything, do you feel like that some member of the FBI or the Department of Justice should have made this public sooner or should have come forth with this information in the trial of Beckwith? Or did you notify headquarters? I understand at one time you wrote a report to them setting forth what happened in the Beckwith case. In the Beckwith? Question, yes. Answer, no, no. When Attorney General Levy got on television pleading with FBI agents who knew of illegal or unethical activity on the part of other FBI agents to come forth and tell them about it, that if they had done something illegal or unethical, they would be given a free ride, well, I had done nothing illegal or unethical, and I didn't want a free ride on anything. But I called the Attorney General's office in Washington and told them that I'd like to furnish information concerning illegal and unethical activity by certain special agents of the FBI in the Jackson, Mississippi area. And they sent 2 assistants, Attorney General, down there to interview me. One of them's name was either Day or O'Day. I don't recall the name of the other one. But they spent about 2 days interviewing me before they concluded the interview and went back to Washington. But all they ever did was to make a memorandum on their interview with me and furnish a copy of it to the FBI. And the FBI sent a couple of goons down here. They were going to physically beat me up and make me retract things that I had said. The illegal activity that I told him about, which I did tell them about, this Beckwith matter. So the FBI knew it early on. This should not come as any shock to them if they would check their records then. Oh, no. No, they got a copy of that memorandum from the Department of Justice guys, and I have expected them to try to do something to me legally. But I can truthfully say, and I'll take a lie detector test to it, I have never had any part of Mr. Beckwith's official FBI file in my possession. Not the file or any part of it. Question. And so do you feel, I noticed you were almost in tears there along about the end in describing your situation, that unless you come forth with this, it may be closed forever? Everybody seems to want to close the book on all of the past, and especially the civil rights cases and the Beckwith case. Answer. I feel that they don't want to do anything to correct the injustice that they have done to Mr. Beckwith and others, which I could tell about, and would if given the opportunity. I tell about all the illegal activity that I can remember. Of course, I haven't written anything down, but I have a pretty fair memory and can remember things that happened. I just can't remember the exact dates on them. I can remember, you know, about when, but I can't remember when, and I can remember what happened. And there's been a lot of illegal activity around here. Question, just one other thing. I'm not paying you anything or giving you anything for this information, but would I be authorized to use it in any way that I could see fit to get the public aware of what did happen and let the truth finally come out? Answer, yes, sir. And I would appreciate it if you would let the Justice Department know that you have this information and that you obtained it from me and that I told you I had previously furnished it to them in 1976. Question. And? Answer. And that I also, wasn't it January of this year? Mr. Dunn, January we went to see. Answer. In January of this year, Mr. Dunn and I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Jackson and talked to Kent McDaniels, the first assistant U.S. attorney, and I outlined and detailed this information that I have just furnished concerning Mr. Beckwith. I outlined and detailed the information to Mr. McDaniels, and he made notes of it. He later informed me that he had sent a communication to the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., but had not heard back from them. I don't know whether he has yet heard from them or not. Question. All right. Is there anything you would like to add on it? As I've mentioned to you, Mrs. Olinsky will transcribe this, and you'll be given an opportunity to check it for accuracy and correct it, and an opportunity to sign it, and then she will certify it as your deposition. Is there anything you would like to add to it? Answer. I'd just like to say that my only hope is that this information becomes public knowledge, and that the Justice Department sees fit to intervene and take some action against Roy K. Moore and the Federal Bureau of Investigation for the illegal activities that they have carried on in Jackson for years. In fact, the illegal activities of Mr. Moore influencing investigation being conducted by the FBI did not end with Mr. Moore resigning or retiring, but he continued to influence investigation of the FBI in certain matters as he interfered in the obstruction of justice case wherein... what's the old boy's name that used to be out on 18 that got assassinated? Mr. Dunn. Leo Hall? Answer. Wherein Leo Hall obtained a list of prospective jurors in his federal case, which was then coming up in Jackson. You don't want to go into details on that, do you? Just make that a separate statement. That's long, too. Question. Leo's dead now? Answer. Yeah. Question. I doubt if you can help him, and of course that's the thing with... Answer. I ain't trying to help him. He doesn't need any help. Question. But he was killed, you know. He was assassinated. Answer. I'd like to do something about Bob Thomas's name. Bob Thomas committed suicide. They said, you know, that he committed suicide because he became involved in the Leo Hall matter. He was ordered to become involved by former Judge Williams. Judge William, what's his name? Mr. Dunn, Cox. Answer, William Harold Cox. Mr. Cox was mixed up with the Dixie Mafia. Question, okay, is there any connection now? You mentioned about putting out false information, particularly during the civil rights, on threats that were being made. Is there anything you could add in that? You had mentioned something about Mr. Ingram and the Tougaloo incident. Answer, yeah. I still can't think. Fitzgerald or Fitzpatrick, Tom Fitzpatrick. Tom Fitzpatrick was a special agent in the FBI office at the time. And he conferred with Jim Ingram. And what's that little old short FBI agent? Looks like a queer to me. I always thought he was queer. Question. Not John, Mr. Dunn. Or we? Phonetic spelling. Or we? Answer. No. Mr. Dunn. Jim or we? Answer. No. Well, this agent and Jim Ingram and Fitzpatrick composed a letter to this guy who was a student at Tougaloo College and was allegedly mixed up in racial activities. And the letter identified the sender as a member of a certain gang of blacks here in Jackson and told this student of Tougaloo if he didn't get out of town, they were going to kill him. And after he composed the letter, Fitzpatrick submitted it to Jim Ingram and Roy Moore, and they approved it, and they sent it to Washington. And it was allegedly approved back there to be sent. And Fitzpatrick actually put the letter in the mail. I don't know what date or where at he put the letter in the mail, but the letter went to this student, and this student was afraid of being killed, and he left the Jackson area on account of that and went to someplace in Pennsylvania. Question. But that was an FBI-initiated threat? Answer. Yeah. It wasn't a threat by any black organization or any black militant or anything. It was strictly a letter that originated in the FBI office by Tom Fitzpatrick. Question. To frighten the student and make him leave Tougaloo? Is that it? Answer. Yeah, make him leave town. Question. How would that help the civil rights? Answer. I don't know how it would help. Question. But that was part of the, what did they call it? Counterintelligence? Answer. Yeah. Question. Program? Answer. Yeah. Question. Okay. All right. Is there anything else you would like to add to this? I know from my experience over the years with the Highway Patrol and dealing with the FBI and everything, it's very, very difficult, you know, how one officer feels about another officer, that we're all in this together, and we all have to stick together and sink or swim together and all that. It's a very difficult thing to do, but you come to a point every now and then where justice and truth has to prevail, and I think it took a lot of courage. The easy thing for everybody seems to be to just forget it and let it go by and just let the record book close, but answer. Well, like Jim Ingram told me about a year or so ago, we were at an ex-FBI agent's luncheon, and I was telling some of the guys around about the illegal activities that I knew Roy Moore was involved in when he was with the FBI. And Jim Ingram came up to me and told me that I'd better quit talking about Roy Moore like that. And I told him, I haven't said anything that wasn't the truth, and as long as I'm telling the truth, I'll say what I want to. And he said, well, something could happen to you if you keep that up. In fact, you could get hurt, inferring that he would hurt me. And I told him, Jim, you do what you have to, and I'll do what I have to. Question. Well, you're almost as big as Jim, but you're in worse shape. Answer. I have a broken back, too, which I haven't mentioned. Question. That's the reason I mentioned it takes a lot of courage to, particularly in this. Everybody feels like you say anything, and answer. I feel like you do. There are only two things I'm afraid of. That's a snake I can hear and can't see, and God. And the only reason I'm afraid of God is respect. It's not that I'm fearful that he's going to do something wrong to me. I respect God. Question. You feel like you can answer. I know that there is a hereafter, and I've got to face God in the hereafter. And I don't want him to say to me, yes, you've done pretty good, but you could have helped people out if you had told the truth about a lot of the things that you knew about. Well, I've tried to tell the truth, but up to now, nobody will. They won't listen to me, or they won't do anything when I do tell them. Question. Well, again, I certainly want to commend you for doing it, because I feel like I'm in the position I am because I have certain constitutional principles that I believe have to be upheld, regardless of who it helps or hurts. But my own, to live with myself. The person we both have to face is ourself when we shave every morning. So if you want to add anything to it or whatever, just let me know, and Mrs. Olinsky will type it up and we'll get a copy to you. Mr. Dunn. Judge, may I say something? Judge Dillard, all right. And the rest was all off the record, ladies and gentlemen. And this is the last page. Certificate of Court Reporter. I, Ruth A. Olinsky, Court Reporter and Notary Public in and for the State of Mississippi at large, hereby certify that the foregoing 28 pages, and including this page, contain a true and correct transcript of the testimony of William R. Stringer, as taken by me at the time and place heretofore stated in the aforementioned matter in stenotype with electronic verification and later reduced to typewritten form to the best of my skill and ability. I further certify that I place the witness under oath to truthfully answer all questions in this matter under the authority vested in me by the State of Mississippi. I further certify that I am not in the employ of or related to any counsel or party in this matter, and have no interest, monetary or otherwise, in the final outcome of this proceeding. Witness my signature and seal this first day of November 1994, signed Ruth Olinsky, CSR. My commission expires August 22nd, 1995. And ladies and gentlemen, we have permission of the source of this to make it available to the public, which we will do. If you would like to have an exact copy, and I mean exact, copy of the original deposition of William R. Stringer, send us $15 postpaid and we'll get it right out to you immediately in the mail. We hope that you use it in the interest of justice and in showing people that the FBI aren't all they're cracked up to be and never have been, ladies and gentlemen. There's a book that's been written by an ex-FBI agent, and I'm not going to get into that tonight, but it also spills the beans on these scum-sucking pigs. Sons of the Gestapo, well, the only people that I've seen in this entire country who have behaved in any manner, even remotely resembled anything, even close to anything called the Gestapo, has been the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Dragnet, their job, to enforce the law and preserve the safety of decent citizens. Decent citizens. Thank you.
Okay, folks, let me give it to you the whole straight skinny here. If you'd like to have a copy of this deposition of William R. Stringer, this is a deathbed deposition, by the way, stand up in any court. He knew he was going to die. Send us $15. A portion of the money that you send will go to the source of this document to help that person in his research. And I don't mind telling you, it was Larry Beecraft. So he will get a portion of the money that you send. Of course, a portion will go to pay for the copies in the mail to send out to you, and a portion will go to fund our research and our efforts here. So send $15, that's postpaid. Make check or money order payable to Annie, nobody else, just Annie. Don't put anything else in that pay line. If you do, I'll send it back to you. Annie, A-N-N-I-E. And send it in an envelope and address the envelope to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420. That's P.O. Box 1420, Sholo, spelled exactly like it sounds, folks. S-H-O-W, new word, L-O-W, Arizona, 85901. That's the Intelligence Service, P.O. Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. You'll also hear the address repeated again at the end of this broadcast. At least I think they still do that. So if you didn't catch it now, wait till the end of the broadcast. All the music is stopped and everything. You should hear it again. Remember, make check or money order payable to Annie only. All of you who ordered your radio transmitters, we were not prepared for the number of orders that we received. We weren't expecting anything like the number that we received. So I've got to tell you that it may take a little longer to deliver them to you, so be patient, because the factory is swamped. And I mean swamped. Looks like we're going to be getting the word out all over this country with these low-power FM broadcast stations. And if you would still like to get in on that, I just talked to the representative at the factory 2 days ago. The prices are still good for the 3-watt FM transmitter, fully tested and assembled with a half-wave dipole antenna. That's $150. $150. Make check or money order payable to Annie and send it to the same address. Also, we have a kit. If you like to put things together and assemble things yourself, and if you have a basic understanding of electronics, you can order the kit and save yourself $50. The kit is $100. $100. Same radio, same quality, only you put it together. So there you have it. Make check or money order payable to Annie and send it to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. And also, we still have the satellite units, which are excellent. And if you get Veritas, there'll be an ad for all of this stuff in Veritas if you'd rather wait and see that. I really don't like to do these things because people put me in a funny position. I'm not a radio dealer. I'm not a satellite dealer. We only did this to help the cause and to help you people out. And we were actually berated, got some nasty letters and some terrible phone calls of people cussing us out because we didn't have a catalog and a price list and all that kind of stuff. And I tell them what I always tell people like that, stick it where the sun don't shine and don't bother sending us any money because that's not what it's all about, and I wouldn't sell anything to those people after they did that to us for all the tea in China. So, there we are. I told you I'm finished with the sheeple. Done with them. Don't care about them. Well, I can't say that. I do care, but I've been racking my head against the wall for too many years. Not going to deal with it anymore, folks. Just with you good people out there who care, who are awake, who are learning, who are studying, who want to do something. to at least help us survive what's coming, if not turn it around and make the future a better place. I hope we can do that. I've got to tell you, though, the longer I deal in this, the smaller and smaller the hope is. Especially when I listen to all the sheeple that claim to be so smart, calling in to all these other shows. It is just incredible. Somebody called me today and said somebody named Joe called Tom Valentine yesterday and told him that I had said that after this war was over, Tom Valentine was going to be in a prison camp. And I got to tell you, Joe, if you're listening, you're either hard of hearing or you're one of the stupidest people that ever walked because you don't understand English. That's not what I said. What I said, Joe, is when this war is over, if the enemy wins, you're going to be in the prison camp. And Tom Valentine's going to be outside with Bobo Grits and others jangling the keys in your face. That's what I said. If you're going to quote me, at least get it right. You know, I don't mind people quoting me. I'm not ashamed of anything I say. I'm in your face, and you know it. But if you're going to quote me correctly, or keep your stupid sheeple mouth shut. For all you good people out there, good night, and God bless each and every single one of you.
People's temple was in reality a mass mind control experiment conducted by the CIA as a follow-up to something called MK Ultra. They had medical checkups for everyone every day.
To take over the world's judicial and political system through mind control by the year 2000.
There are a lot of mind control experimentation going on. Control of individuals, control of groups, control of whole populations.
The new world order. The cheapest commodity in the world is human beings.
Time.